Hello, 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 and welcome to Buzz to Binge. My name is Natalie.
And I'm Christy, her mom.
And we are going to be covering season one, episodes 4 and 5 of Downton Abbey. And now she's sick too.
Yeah, I really am looking forward to sharing. At least, you know, we're not going to be in your house sharing whatever virus this is. So I guess that's something. But yeah, we're excited actually to be getting into Downton Abbey. And of course, this first season is such a great establishment of this universe, so it's going to be really fun for us to be going through this, and we hope that you are enjoying watching Downton Abbey along with us. We have our usual caveats, which include that we may have cursing. There will be, of course, spoilers if you've not watched Downton Abbey. We watched it several times, so it might be hard for us to restrain ourselves. And we're having things to drink. So what are you having, Natalie?
I'm having Earl Grey Jasmine tea.
That is a good choice.
Yeah.
It combines two teas you like, right?
Mm-hmm.
Boy, you're talkative today.
Yeah, we're still getting over this virus. I think me and my dad got diagnosed with bronchitis, so we're going through the motions now, but I'm on antibiotics.
Well, I've been exposed to a lot of mold recently, so, you know, it is what it is, people. But I am having what is from my Downton Abbey cocktail book, the Abbey cocktail. So the Cocktail that I had for the first episode is actually a variation on the Abbey cocktail. This includes gin, Coke Americano, but it has orange juice, and it says for guests, you can add a float of champagne. Since I'm not a big gin drinker, when I made the cocktail originally and I tasted it, I was like, you know, this really kind of needs a float of champagne for me to enjoy it, because it kind of dilutes that very strong gin flavor. So with the float of champagne, it's a little like a mimosa. It's not very much like a mimosa, but it is a gin-based cocktail. And if you're into gin, this is probably something you might enjoy. It's not my favorite. I'm still looking for my favorite out of this book, but that's why we have the book, and that's why we are doing this, so that we can discover what a favorite might be. So we want to discuss what are our subjects going to be for episode or part or whatever we're calling
episode
it.
Four. The sections that I have, and I guess we're treating them as gospel. The sections are Branson and Sybil, Molesley's hands, which will be explained, the fair, which covers a lot, and the great matter, which also covers a lot. All of these things will be explained. We can get through a couple of these pretty quickly. Like, let's start with Molesley's hands.
Yes,
super short. So basically what's going on with Molesley is that he has a rash and on his
right
hands.
Now, just as a reminder, Molesley is the butler, valet, every guy at
Crawley House,
and Isabella notices that he has a rash on his hands, and so because she is so medically whatever, she like diagnoses him as having what?
I have no idea. Well, I forget every single time.
Erysipelas or something.
Erysipelas.
Or no, it's not syphilis. It's not.
Not syphilis. Not no. Molesley. But so. She diagnoses him with that, with erysipelas. Damn it. I can't unsay it now.
You know what you want to say now.
No, but so it goes on for a couple days, and the rash is not getting any better.
So she basically forces a nurse to break into the medicine cabinet at the hospital.
Yeah. And so she gets him droplets of silver and nitrates of steel or whatever to help him, but it doesn't get better over the next couple days. And so they come back, but Violet is there talking to Dr. Clarkson about something or other. And she notices the rash and is just like, oh, it's not getting better, is it? Hey, Molesley, have you been helping out
your dad
in the garden? And getting rid of that old rue hedge, and then, which is so specific.
Yeah, it's like, and she was, no, he says it. Oh yeah, that rue hedge.
No, he doesn't. She says rue hedge, and then he's like, "How did you know?" And then she's like, "This is a rue allergy," and I'm like, "How the fuck do you know that?"
Right. I mean, it would make more sense to me if this were like poison ivy or something,
or if like he had like. Or he's like predisposed to having a rue allergy somehow. Like
I
don't know how she has that knowledge of that as a specific allergy.
Rue allergy. You know, wear some gloves when you're in the garden, and you'll be fine a few days. And she turns to Isabel, and this is one of those great, brilliantly written and brilliantly delivered lines. Like, you could not have this without Maggie Smith. But she's like, sometimes we need to leave these things to the professionals.
Yeah, and this is honestly, like, I do love how adversarial Isabel and Violet are most of the time. I don't think they need to have a feature of that kind of relationship in every episode this season, which is kind of, because they have a better one in the next episode. And so I think that them just constantly, like, I think the point of this storyline is just so that it can prove that Violet knows what she's doing, and that's why she's the chairman of the board of the hospital.
Right.
And so she actually does have experience with the people, with the hospital, and with, like, doctors.
With local illnesses, too.
Exactly.
Like, I mean, she understands what's going on with stuff. The locals.
So I think that was a good idea for it to be like, oh, well, Isabel isn't the only one who knows about
medical
stuff. But the knowledge of the village really helps with Violet. So I think that was smart, and I'm glad it doesn't take up much of the episode, because if it did, I'd be very bored.
Oh God.
Yeah. But it takes up just enough. It's fine. It's probably one of my worst parts, only because it's kind of just there and it's kind of
eh. Oh no, I have a worse part. We haven't gotten to that yet. So whatever. So our next little section is,
do you want to do Branson and Sybil?
Yeah, let's do Branson and Sybil, because it's pretty quick. So Branson has come to replace the other chauffeur, the older chauffeur, who's retiring and opening a tea shop. And as Carson puts it, it's like,
I'd rather be put to death, my lord,
than do a tea shop.
Or leave down in general or retire.
And, right. And so the introduction to him is, you know, he's meeting Robert, the Earl, and he's very impressed with the library, and he says, you know, I do like to read. I like politics.
He's Irish also, by the way.
Right.
That's kind of important.
Well, he's also new blood too. So he mentions that the woman he used to work for in Ireland just wouldn't let him drive above 20 miles an hour. And he said he was kind of boring, and he's looking forward to like new cars and new going faster and just all the things. And Robert is kind of intrigued by that.
Yeah.
And he's like, you know, I make everybody check out books. You have to write your name in, but, you know, and he tells Carson, let him have as many books as he wants,
because he's interested in history and politics.
Right.
And so later on, Sybil, Edith, and Cora are all at, like, just in the village, and they're being taken back to the house by Branson in the car, and they're talking about how Sybil's going to get this new frock. And
right, because this, again, when you think about in those times, you have to get measured, it has to be made, the fabric has to be brought in. It is a very long, complicated, expensive process to get these very dressy evening frocks.
Yes.
So they have a person in Ripon who does this for them.
Yes. And so Sybil mentions that she wants something new and doesn't want the same old frock and all that stuff. And they kind of joke about, oh yeah, women's rights really do start in the home. And Branson overhears this. And so later on, when he's just driving Sybil, he mentions, oh, I heard that you might be interested in like women's rights and all that stuff. If you were really interested in doing these pamphlets, because
deal with the vote.
Yeah. That if you're interested in the vote or anything like that, pamphlets, you can look into it.
Right, because during that period, women still did not have the vote. And so this was suffragette time, and it was very revolutionary for women to even be talking about, especially a woman in Sybil's position.
Mm-hmm.
So, you know, she is cutting in. She's like, oh, don't tell mom, don't tell, you know,
well, specifically, grandma. Don't tell her father or her grandmother.
You're right.
Because they would see it as a coup. And so, like, she could hear the rattling of a guillotine or something. Yeah, it's funny.
Cute,
but so basically, what Sybil does, and she also does is helping out Gwen at this point. She they have responded to an advertisement. There's going to be an interview, but then the interview's canceled because they find somebody better. And so Gwen is feeling down, but Sybil's like, no, we're going to fight this. We're going to find you a different one. Right. We're gonna do this for you. I'm gonna make sure that your dreams come true, that kind of thing.
Well, that and this idea of women going to work, you know, like work other than service work, it is revolutionary for this group of people. So I think that her encouragement of Gwen is seen as part of that too. And it's also seen as a kindness by the people in the servants hall, but it's seen as kind of a revolutionary concept by the older servants and by the gentry people.
Yes.
So it is a very interesting dynamic between Sybil and Gwen. And it's fun that they're exploring it in this context.
Yeah. And so Sybil at dinner that night, even though it's bright as fuck in that room.
It's summer. I mean,
yes, but it was really dark before when they were doing dinner before. They have dinner at 8 o'clock.
Well, okay. I want to point out, and you've not spent summer in England, is much farther north.
Yes.
And when your Aunt Lisa and I were in London for the summer, you know, when you hit this time of year, like summer solstice in England, it is light till like 11 o'clock at night. It's crazy.
All I'm saying is that they had a dinner scene before in this episode and it was darker. That's all I'm saying.
Okay.
But it's very bright. Mm-hmm. And so she comes in and it's pants. And it's
harem pants.
Yes.
Like floaty blue harem pants. And she's got this very ornate like headdress and belt, and it's actually a beautiful garment.
Oh, it looks great.
But, you know, it looks
and Branson is outside and he sees her through the window and smiles. And
it's a little creepy because, you know, you see him looking through the window, it's like peeping Tom.
literally, his name's Tom.
Yeah.
but
he is smiling, he's encouraging because he's like, oh, you go, girl.
Free spirit, kind of.
Yeah.
Kindred spirits.
Yeah, he loves it.
And so, and just seeing everyone's face is really funny.
Yeah.
So that's basically all Sybil and Branson for this episode. Do you want to do the fair or the great matter?
You know, it's hard because the great matter, of course, involves Matthew and Mary, and I feel like they are kind of central to this whole story. We can do the fair. There are a lot of subparts to the fair.
Yes.
So we need to start, and this episode starts even with, you know, the fair has come to town, and you see, and it doesn't start with Mrs. Hughes, but Mrs. Hughes, they're all talking, all the servants are talking about going to the fair. Mary is actually in town. Lady Mary's in
the village.
The village, I'm sorry. And you know, she and Anna talk about, you know, is her mother over, like all this stuff.
Well, I think we should talk about that in the great matter section.
Right. But so that the major thing is that Mrs. Hughes is going to the fair and she's taking a day off, which is very unlike her.
Mm-hmm.
And she wants to, she even asks O'Brien for help, like, hey, you know, can we brighten up my hat? Hey, can you cover the girls? Because Anna's sick. Can you take care of them? And O'Brien is just, I mean, it is so illustrative of how awful she is.
Well, I think
in this episode,
the worst part about the situation is that I can understand why she's upset.
Oh, sure.
Because she already is taking care of Cora. Mm-hmm. And now that Anna is sick, Anna, who already like takes care of three people instead of the one,
right,
which is already,
that's a little crazy.
It's kind of crazy that she doesn't have more of a race than O'Brien, but whatever. Mm-hmm. But so O'Brien's gonna have to look after all four of them, which is kind of, it's a lot, it's to a ask lot,
sure.
And so they're just it's understandable why she's upset, but her constantly complaining about it is annoying.
Well, and her tone, when does she complain about it? Some of it is quite funny and sharp, but some of it is also like, God, she's a terrible person.
I'm sewing like a cursed princess in a fairy tale.
Exactly. It is funny. But she is basically like ugly to Mrs. Hughes. Like, well, you know, I don't have time to help you with your hat.
Mrs. Hughes is like, all right, you have to take care of these three girls. Also, can you do this hat thing for me on the side just real quick? And it's like, no. Now I don't have time because you just told me I have to look after four people tonight.
Right.
So, and tomorrow morning. And it's
right, because Anna's sick, but you can't control the fact that Anna's sick. And there are limitations on staff and everything else. So, but Mrs. Hughes is taking the day off, and it, you know, she's very anxious about it. But everyone points out to her, even O'Brien, you know, is kind of like, well, yeah, you never take a day off, so okay. You know, even though she's resentful about it, Mr. Carson's kind of like, you never take time off, go, just get out of here.
And he even gets a little bit stressed while she's gone.
Right. But part of why he is stressed is it's so clear that there's no one who is Mrs. Hughes in this house. And that's part of what this episode is about, is that no one sees or manages the politics of the downstairs like Mrs. Hughes.
Yeah.
And she keeps, and at one point William even says this to her, I don't know how this place would run without you. And exactly. She takes that to heart.
Well, let's be more clear. So she goes to the fair and she is just walking around, and then she sees this guy, and
he confronts her, he's Elsie.
Yes. And
because they haven't seen each other in 20 years or something.
Whatever. And so he's just like, oh yeah, well, her old flame, Mr. Burns or whatever, yes. Not from The Simpsons, the different guy.
Yeah.
And so he's walking around, they're walking around, he wins her a little mini scarecrow thing, little doll.
Right, they have dinner, they talk about the fact that they used to be
in love.
In love, that he had been married, he's a widow.
A widower of 3 years.
Right, and that his son's grown up and left him, and he's like, look, I'm still interested. I'd like to marry you.
Because she, and then we get context later, but he's basically like, yeah, I want to marry you. And then she's just like, but I'll give you time to think about it. I'll be in the village. Just hit me up if you want to talk.
I'll wait.
And so, yeah, because I'd rather get a good answer in more time than a quick one that we're both going to regret.
Right.
So she goes back to the house and she thinks about it, and she eventually goes back to him and declines, and she's telling Mr. Carson basically the entire story of how she was a farmer's daughter and she fell in love with a farmhand, and
he became a farmer,
and she was right when she was about to be head housemaid at Downton and start her life of service, he asked her to marry him.
Mm-hmm.
And she was like, all right, I'll think about it. And then she knew she had a good thing at Downton and she didn't want to mess that up. And so she declined, and he went and married somebody else. And
well, and Carson's so cute, right? He's like, and he's fat and old and terrible and
awful now. And then she's like, no.
He was the same. Carson's a little disappointed. It's so sweet.
He's a little jealous. It's funny.
Yeah.
But he basically lived up to all of her former expectations. She still sees him as that farmhand or that farmer or whatever that she once knew and was in love with, but she has changed as a person. And she again, likes where she is right now in her life. She doesn't really need or want any more change, big change like that,
right.
Big changes like that.
Well, right, she's, and this is a theme in this episode. Like, so she is recognizing that she has changed, and she, you know, this is not something that is still.
I'm not that farmer's daughter anymore.
Right,
it's not something I want anymore.
But that theme carries over into The Great Matter with Matthew. So yes. We will address that too. But Carson's kind of like, life should change us. If it doesn't change us, we're doing it wrong, kind of thing.
But she's still content with where she is, and so she doesn't.
Right, but
she stands by.
Right, a number of things that happen in this. You see her like seeing the bigger picture of like this atmosphere with the servants, and you know William getting picked on, and she knows that she's the person who's going to have to intervene and try to fix it and comfort him, and you know deal with O'Brien being an ass and deal with mm-hmm. Thomas and Daisy and whatever. So, and Thomas and Daisy are part of this whole fair. Discussion.
So let's get to them, because we basically finished up with Mrs. Hughes, except right. for a little bit with William later. Mm. So basically what happens is one day that like once the fair news has gone around, William goes into the servants' hall and offhandedly is just like, oh yeah, well, do you think Daisy wants to go to the fair or anything tonight? And I think Bates is like, yeah, you should go and ask her.
And he's about to.
When Thomas is like, hey, do you want to go to the fair tonight, Daisy? And before William gets a chance, and she's like, yes.
And she's so in love with Thomas.
It's so gross. And so William is pissed off because that's shitty.
Right.
And
Thomas keeps intervening. So like when they're actually at the fair, Thomas sees Mrs. Hughes with a guy and he's kind of like, that's not her brother. She doesn't have a brother.
She has a sister, which will come into effect way later, but I'm glad they at least remembered
it. Right. But Thomas, you know, is kind of like, we've got to figure out who this guy is. He's such a gossipy intrigue.
I would know about it. It's like, okay.
Yeah. And Daisy's like, oh, he's so smart. He knows everything. And William's kind of like, ugh.
And there's also a moment where like he catches a tray and she's like, oh, he's so agile. He should be a sportsman. It's like, fuck you.
Vomit. Right. And William is feeling oh vomit too. And so he's so frustrated. He leaves and Gwen's
with them.
Right. And Gwen's kind of like, don't go. She's being
no, idiot. She basically, what happens is William says something along the lines of he does not know everything. Like it's a smear on Thomas's name, what he says.
Not much, but
yeah. Not really. It really wasn't that big of a deal. And then Daisy's like, oh, if you're going to be a spoiled sport, just go away. And so William's like, fine, I will. And then Gwen's just like, well, she didn't mean it. It's like, no, I think she meant it. And she's being an awful person. Mm-hmm. And then when they get back from the fair, and Mrs. Hughes is watching all of this, which kind of connects them. Mm-hmm. Bates is kind of like, hey, William, how was the fair? Mm-hmm. And William's like, I don't really want to talk about it. And Bates keeps trying to talk to him about it, but because he knows he was there when the whole thing
Thomas
went down.
Being terrible. And he knows Thomas is terrible and he's trying to help.
Yeah. And so, but that doesn't really matter because like William's just going to leave anyway. So he goes upstairs and Daisy and Thomas get in and they start gossiping about Mrs. Hughes. Mrs. Hughes has left the room at this point.
Right.
And they're just like, oh, I can't imagine her having a fancy
and
man.
Bates is like, Daisy, this is not you.
Well, he's basically like, you're being very mean, Daisy, and it's not becoming. And it's like, and I love that she listens to him about it. And it's just like, oh, well, maybe I am being a little bit of a
right.
bitch.
Right. I mean, she wants to impress Thomas, which is why she's doing these awful things. And she does it again the next day. And everyone's seeing it. Everyone's seeing how Thomas is influencing Daisy for the worse. And so they're all kind of like, just stop. Just don't. Well, you don't want to be him.
Before that instance in the morning, they're at night. Bates goes to William's room and William is praying, but he's really upset. And Bates knows this. And again, he tries to talk to him, but William doesn't want to talk. And then he Bates sees Thomas in the hall and then he like pushes him up against the wall and is just like, you need to leave that guy alone. Like you need to get Bud out of his life or I will hurt you. And
Thomas is like, are you trying to scare me?
Cause it's not working. And then.
Cause he's such a bully. And I love that Bates is like, I'm not living with this.
Yeah. And so then, but then like, Bates just kind of goes to bed. It's like there's not really much use in trying to do that at this point, but he tried.
Right. And we do start to see like the issues with Thomas is the next couple episodes.
Yeah, but then that morning when William comes in to like bring some stuff up to the dining room, he doesn't have his vest buttoned up and Thomas is like, what do you look like? Daisy, what does he look like? Just to embarrass him.
Right. And Daisy hadn't noticed, honestly.
And then Daisy's just like, he's like, button up your vest. And then Daisy's like, go on, do it. Once they pointed it out and everything, and Gwen's there too, because she's kind of there and for everything.
Right.
And so he buttons up his vest and it's very embarrassing for him. And it's just, it's sad. I like William and I don't think he deserves to be this.
Right. And of course, Daisy, you know, being so influenced by Thomas is awful because she's so impressionable.
And that comes into play later.
It does.
Important to lay the groundwork now. But there's also a moment where William is sadly playing piano and Mrs. Hughes comes in and is just like,
also really good.
He's good at piano. That's the whole point.
Yeah.
That's why he's playing. But Mrs. Hughes comes in and is like, I would stop you, but I love hearing you play. And then she's just like, you can't let Thomas
get you down.
And he's just jealous because you were so much more well-liked. And then William's just like, not by everybody. And she's just like, well, she's a stupid girl and she'll get over it.
Right.
And
right.
that doesn't even matter, dude. Don't worry about it. Right. And so, yeah.
The only other thing that comes into play with the fair is that Anna can't go because she's sick.
Yeah, so she has a cold.
She has a cold, and there is a very sweet exchange between her and Bates.
Yeah, Bates asks, oh, did she get any food? It's a lot like when in the first episode when she brings him food.
Right. He brings her a tray of little flowers.
It's so cute.
It's so cute. And you see that one of the things the show does really, really well, and it is a multiple element thing, is you've got great acting in so much of what happens between Bates and Anna particularly is nonverbal. Mm-hmm. It is exchanges and those kinds of things that are supported by this beautiful score. They have theme for Anna and Bates.
And for Matthew.
This kind of melancholy love.
Almost sad.
Yeah, but
you don't know why it's sad yet. But,
but it's kind of a little, this longing.
Yeah.
And Matthew and Mary have these longing glances as well. There's just this, ooh, you know, I really
wish it's a little bit more of the triumphant kind of swell.
Eventually. But this is this, you know, are we ever going to be able to make this work?
What's his big secret? What's up with that?
There's clearly a secret for Bates. There's clearly this love from Anna, and he loves her, but he is withholding something.
Yeah,
and she knows it, and that comes up over and over. But it is beautifully done. You can tell how much he wants to give her more, but he's restraining himself. You see it initially as a stiff British stiff upper lip thing. As things progress, you realize there's more to it.
Yes.
But she is such a good overall human that you want good things for Anna.
Mm-hmm.
So it's really kind of cool to see this progression and see how it's portrayed in this show.
Yes. And so that's basically all that happens at the fair.
There's the great matter.
The great matter. So as mentioned before, we start the episode at the fair. Mary's just kind of wandering around, and so are the servants. And Anna breaks off from the servants group to talk to Mary.
They're setting up the fair at this point. It hasn't actually started.
Yes. And Anna goes up to Mary, and she's just like, well, has her ladyship, Cora, recovered yet? And she's like, I think that when she dies, it's going to be carved out on her heart, and she's never going to get over it, and she's never really going to forgive me.
Yeah.
And I must say, before we even get into it, I love Mary's arc in this episode. I'll talk about it more later on because it gets better.
Right. But you see that Mary is becoming more self-aware. And I guess this is what it takes for somebody like her. She even says, like, oh, don't you know that I don't have a heart?
Yeah, she says, haven't you heard I don't have a heart? Everyone knows that.
Right. But you see that she is starting to understand, number one, how she appears to others, but number two, that she is not, things aren't going to be handed to her.
At least at this point, yeah. Now that she has this thing marking her, this dark mark almost, not Harry Potter,
that black spot on her head,
that kind of thing. Yeah. And now that there's something that can be held against her, it's not going to come as easily to her.
Right.
And since she's so stubborn, it's less likely, and the whole entail thing is she's not getting what she wants, and she has, and now she's fully more aware of how that might affect her now that she has something that can be held against her.
Right.
And so she's a little bit, she's trying not to become more desperate than she is, but it's getting desperate.
So we segue into, as part of the great matter, the Dowager Countess,
Violet,
is talking to Cora about, mm-hmm. like, oh, well, what's Mary doing? Like, because it is such a big deal, like, where is the family going, kind of thing. So it's such a big deal. Like, oh, she's got tea with these people. And Violet's kind of like, oh shit, you know, that's nothing. But everyone there is going to be 100 years old. No one she's going to be interested in. She needs to, you know, have better options.
Mm-hmm.
And they also talk about, like, hey, you know, maybe we need to talk to somebody who has a lawyer who has a vested interest in the outcome of this entail. And they realize, Hey,
we know a lawyer,
and his name is Matthew Crawley.
And so Violet goes to visit Matthew in his office.
You've got these brilliant exchanges with Maggie Smith just in the office. She's sitting in a chair and it swivels, and she's like, "What is this?" When did they invent these swivel chairs? And he's like, "Well, it was actually invented by Thomas Jefferson, an American." And she's like, "Why is every day in a conflict with an American?"
It's so funny. She basically is like, "Matthew, I just want to know all the details about the entail and what we can do about it, if anything. I just want to know the details and understand it." And right. So Matthew's like, "Okay, I'll look into it." And so,
well, and he understands too, because he is still at that point very conflicted about his role.
Yes.
He doesn't, he felt like it was a joke that he was going to inherit. He wasn't really vested in the idea of being landed gentry. He never expected it. He never thought it would ever happen to him. And he was kind of like resistant to the whole concept. So he explores it. And he even, he tells her, like, "I've got to look at this and this and this." She's like, "Do it," to Violet. And he sees Mary later. They're both at the fair, and he's like, you know, throwing stuff at
the bottles
of bottles or whatever, and they have a chat, and he's like, "Look, is your dad getting him back? Because they talk to him because your grandmother came to see me." And Mary's curious
about, but he doesn't tell her anything.
He doesn't tell her, but it's clear to me, or it's clear to everybody in the conversation, including Mary, that he cares about how Mary is going to be dealing with all of this
and react to
it. Well, and her role in this, right?
Oh,
like,
for sure.
He doesn't want to be taking away from her. And so he's like, "Look, I've got to talk to your dad. Is he getting me home?" She's like, "Yeah." He's like, "I'll come up after dinner.
You could let me in. Yeah. And all that stuff." And so that night, Mary mentions this to Robert, and Robert
looks amazing, by the
way. She has a cream colored dress.
Oh my God, it's beautiful.
Anyway, Robert basically tells her, "Hey, keep your grandmother occupied, keep her away from that room after dinner." And she's like, "Okay, cool." And so Matthew does come after.
See these longing looks between, and this is something that Dan Stevens, as Matthew, does so, so well. He is sitting in this ante area. Like, so they have the front door to Downton has
like door, a glass
an outdoor
box.
Door and then a glass inner door, like you'd see maybe in a hotel or something. So he's standing in that ante room, and they make eye contact because the women are going into the drawing room, which is, you know, the habit after dinner. It's the women go into the drawing room, men go into the smoking room and have brandy and cigars.
Either that or
stay guy stuff.
Or either that or stay in the dining room and
do guy stuff.
Yeah.
But Matthew's sitting there, and and Mary turns back. You know, he's looking at her back like, "I really love you," kind of thing. He's kind of longing. "Oh my God, you are like,
you look amazing.
You look amazing," kind of thing. And she turns back, and she does look amazing. And she makes eye contact with him, and she's like, "Okay, I'll let you in," kind of thing. And she lets him in, and he goes to talk to Robert, and he's like, he tells Robert, and we see this separately. So, like, you know, Mary's in with the women and, you know, whatever's happening in the drawing room. But we see the exchange between Matthew and Robert, where he's like, "Look, I've looked into it.
You can't do it.
You can't do it." And Robert's like, "I could have told you that." And so, and he's like, "Well, okay."
Matthew basically says that he's just scared of what Violet will say and what Mary will think, because he thinks Mary's going to hate him because she'll think that, oh, he didn't even want to break the entail. He just wants to inherit, and he just wants to take everything away from me. That's what he thinks Mary's going to think. And he thinks that Violet's also going to think similarly of, like, you didn't even try.
Right.
Much like everybody else, you're just trying to get the money.
Right. And so Carson had brought the guys brandy or whatever. Mm-hmm. And he goes in to serve the women in the drawing room. And Violet's like, "Oh, yeah, where's Robert? He should be here by now." And Carson starts to say he's in the library with Mr. Crawley. And Mary's trying to, like, you know, give him the eye, like, "Don't say Crawley," you know, that kind of thing. And eventually he does. And so while Matthew's having a conversation with Robert's like, I can handle my mom. And she's like, oh, really? You've never been able to do it so far, you know, because she overhears.
You must have learned how to do so very recently.
Right. And so, again, these exchanges are so brilliantly acted. It's so worth watching in person because, yeah,
we can't. In person.
Well, I mean, watching it yourself because our discussion of it is limited.
I was about to say, there were no live tapings. You don't
know. No, although that would be fun. And I'd like to touch the
letter. No, stop. Okay, so, you know what? I know. And Violet's really pissed at Robert and kind of at Matthew as well. But so she leaves and
she's pissed for Mary. She wants Mary because they love Mary and they see so much potential in her.
And they also don't see it as fair. Right. So
and Mary's very hurt.
So can I explain? Mm-hmm. She goes, Violet goes home. And Robert's just like, Carson asks Robert, okay, well, what do you want to do about Lady Mary and Mr. Crawley? And it's just like, oh, just leave them. They'll ring for you. I'm going upstairs. I'm not going to deal with this anymore.
Right.
And so Matthew and Mary are talking, and apparently to even try to break the entail, they'd need a whole new bill in Parliament.
And that would only be passed
if, or even considered if, the only reason that would be considered is if the estate is in danger, which it is not. So they are, so Mary's just like, so I don't matter in this at all. Like nobody really cares
and
about
Matthew
this.
Matthew does exactly the right thing here. And he says to her, no, you matter very much.
You
and
matter a great deal.
You matter a great deal. And I hate, basically I hate this for you.
Yeah.
And I don't know how to make it right. I don't. You know, and Mary acknowledges, like, I guess that's what I have left is that you're.
I guess that's just my life. And yeah. They have this one line. Let me see if I can find it.
Great. Yeah, where she's angry. She's.
Oh, I got it. I got it. There were a couple of lines that are iconic in this scene. I don't know what she says before this, but Matthew recites something she said to him, and Mary says, you should learn to forget what I say, which will come back later in a really iconic scene later. And so then he's just like, you must be very angry at me. And she says, my life makes me angry, not you.
Right.
Which is so cute.
Well, for her to acknowledge, because up until this point, you feel like it's personal, and that self-realization for Mary that this is more than that.
It can still feel personal for her, mm-hmm. considering at least Matthew looked into it more, or at least
right, but it's
what
not
she
against him. So like she had been up until this point, like Matthew, I hate Matthew, blah, blah, blah. But it's much more of a, I hate that I have nothing. Right. Mm-hmm. I hate that the law doesn't acknowledge me kind of thing.
Yeah. And so she's basically like thinking about her lot in life, especially since now that she might be she is damaged goods in the eyes of only a couple of people, but it could get out. The fact that she is damaged goods lessens her chances of getting a good husband that she can be happy with. Or be comfortable with, or whatever.
Right.
She will become more desperate for suitors, and that is not the position she wants to be in.
Well, and earlier in the episode, and maybe even here, she's like, I hate my life. I'm always in a waiting room. Like, you know, I do charity work. I do this. I do that. But I'm nothing until I'm married. Mm-hmm. I have no real life. I have no purpose until I'm married, and that's my lot in life. And she had said that earlier at the fairgrounds, and now it's like more obvious to her, and she's like, you know, I guess I just need to be happy with the fact that at least you acknowledge there's a problem. Matthew also does the right thing with Carson. He's leaving and he has a conversation with Carson.
Carson definitely respects him more after this because he can see how much he actually cares about what Lady Mary thinks about what, like, just her position
and what the servants think. The fact that he's having the conversation with Carson acknowledges, like, Carson's a person. You are entitled to an opinion, and this is hard for all of us, and includes you.
Mm-hmm.
I'm having this conversation with you because I know you are affected by the fact that I'm taking over, and I know you would much rather see it stay in the family, kind of thing. Mm-hmm. Which again, it's really again, you come into this, Matthew is again like an insert for us, like Daisy is downstairs. He's an insert for us that, you know, I'm an outsider, I'm coming into this, and he is much more self-aware, right? So yeah. His self-awareness, like, oh, this is really awful for everybody, is a great way to see how his existence, the fact that he's now the heir, affects every single person in the house.
Yes. So later on, Mary and Robert are walking, and she's basically like, the person who's disappointed me most in this situation is you, because I just don't feel like you're fighting for me at all. And he's just like, that is not the case. If I could, I would, but I know for a fact that if we tried to challenge the entail, we wouldn't be able to do it. And we wouldn't be able to get anything for you. And also this is not all my work. That if it was all mine and it was all my money and all that stuff, I would be more willing. I'll give
it to you in a second.
But this is not just my work. It is, should I sacrifice all of the work that others have put into this just for you or Matthew to just have a title somewhere else, that like right. Earl of nothing, right. or Countess of nothing.
Right. He uses the term custodian. I am just a custodian. I'm not an owner. This is not my life's work. It is not your, it's a dynasty. And the dynasty is more than me or you or my personal anything. This has to do with our country and our queen. I mean, and again, I'm bringing some of my own personal knowledge of English law into it, but you know, the way these properties are, it isn't his. Everything is sheets to the crown, right? Yeah. So he is holding this and he is responsible for this on behalf of the country as a whole.
Yes.
And he sees that responsibility very seriously, which not everybody does.
But in particular, he does.
He does. And trying to explain it to Mary. And I think he had probably had these conversations with Patrick, who was supposed to inherit.
Oh, for sure.
Before, because Patrick had been in the house like 8,000 times. And it's part of the reason. And I do love that he had brought Matthew in long before he died, right? Like he's not going to be giving this to Matthew in a vacuum. Like, yeah. Matthew, you're just
he's not going to get a letter in the mail when Robert dies and it's just like, all right, here's your brownie.
Good luck.
Have fun.
Yeah.
But so basically that's what happens in that scene. Mary's still disappointed, but that's basically the whole scene. Then you get a couple of quick scenes of Matthew and Robert going around to the different tenants and the cottages that they're like repairing. And Matthew's more invigorated now because he can see what's going on in the community, and he wants Down to be his future now.
Because, well, and he knows he's not getting out of it,
right? Especially not now that Mary can't inherit.
Right.
And so he feels compelled to do more of the work now that he knows it's going to go to you regardless.
Right.
And he no longer once he gets it, it's no longer an option for him in his mind to just give it up.
And he tells Robert, he's like, I'm sorry, I took this as a joke.
Early. I'm sorry, I was a prick before.
Yeah, basically.
Which is good. Yeah, and he acknowledges it now, and he has all these new ideas, and he does want to implement them. So,
which is cool.
Yeah, it's great. And they get along, and it's going great. And then at dinner, or after dinner that night, Mary is sitting there, and she's just hearing all of these things, good things about Matthew that Robert is saying. It's like
it's too much for her.
It's a lot, because now that she feels like she's been thrown over for Matthew by her father.
Right. And she's like, oh, he has the son now that he wants. She leaves the room because she's very upset, and her mother goes to her, Cora goes to her,
and she's crying,
and Mary's crying, and Cora's like, what, hey, you know, can I help? And Mary's just like, he has the son he always wanted. It's Matthew, Matthew, Matthew. And it humanizes her on some level.
Oh, I love this scene.
And yeah, and Cora says to her, it's like, no, that's not it. Your father loves you, but he can't fix this. He can't change it.
But I think it's more the principle of fighting for it, or at least trying, or she's seen the Matthew at least. Okay. I think what the issue is with Mary is that she has seen that Matthew, Violet, and Cora, to kind of a certain extent, have been fighting a little bit more and been like, all right, let's look into it more. Let's at least make some more of an effort. She hasn't really seen that much effort from Robert, even though he probably already did all this way before now.
Well, I mean, he did it in the context of talking to the solicitor, right?
Yeah, with like talking to Murray, talking about when Patrick died. She didn't see all the stuff that was going on behind the scenes. She didn't see him making those trips to London to talk to Murray about this or anything like that.
Right.
So she just thinks it was all done and dusted just years ago, and she's just never going to inherit. And he's
right.
just
and nobody cares,
that.
right?
And nobody cares. And him in particular, he doesn't care because he doesn't want her. Maybe she thinks that he doesn't want her to inherit in general, because that's what she doesn't think Cora wants her to inherit, because now that she like has sullied her name at this point.
Right. She even says that she's like, oh, I'm you're
not any better because you don't think I deserve it.
Right.
Especially after everything I've done.
Right. And again, you know, Cora's kind of like, that's not true. I love you. I want the best for you. And I want to make sure like the world doesn't know about like all this shit with you. But she, and they have other conversations about that come up again. But Mary's self-awareness in this episode is really very important.
It's important. And I also think that in general, I just love that they at least remark on the fact that Cora is going to see her daughter differently, considering what she knows now.
Yeah.
And how she doesn't necessarily, okay, she does kind of hold it against her, but she, at the same time, it's not to the extent of, I don't want you to inherit because I know you did this.
Right.
It's more, I know what you did. We have fewer options now.
Right.
You need
We've
to
gotta
listen
work
to
harder.
Me.
We've got to work
and harder. She's more doing it in that kind of frame of mind. But it's only natural to see your daughter differently after that. Yeah. And so I'm glad they remarked on that. And I'm glad they finally got to a point where she confronts her feelings about how she thinks Robert hasn't really done much for her.
Okay, and I'm going to say this because we've spent a lot of time talking about this one episode, and of course this is a double Downton Abbey episode of Buzz Binging. There is a lot of development here that I probably didn't expect here. What was your best part of this episode?
I had a few. I had Matthew, because I like that he is trying to, as promised, he did look into it and he did put some effort in, and he really doesn't want. I just also love the Mary Matthew content in this episode in general, but I also just like how he genuinely doesn't want to make Mary feel like she's being thrown over, but he inevitably it's going to feel that way, but he wants to make her feel better about the situation by at least being honest with her. And Mary's, I love Mary's arc in this because it mentions a lot of like unresolved feelings that just exist now based off of everything that's been happening. Bates, I really like in this episode because he stands up to Thomas and tries to take care of William and gives Anna the food. It's really cute. I just like him standing up for everybody in this episode and not having to deal with some other shit, because it's very rare to see. And Sybil, I think Sybil's fun in this episode. It's brief, it's cute. Go Sybil, love those pants. Go ahead, what about your favorite parts?
I wrote down less than that, but I acknowledge all of that. I like Mrs. Hughes finding herself, like acknowledging, like, I have changed and those kinds of things. I like Mary finding herself, you know, or because she doesn't find herself. Mrs. Hughes finds herself. Mary has a level of self-awareness that she has not had up until this point. She's just been like cocky, I win everything. And I like her, again, that sense of comeuppance. Like, you are going to have to deal with the fact that things aren't going to be handed to you. And I think that, you know, how she addresses that is a huge theme in Downton Abbey as a show. What were your worst parts?
I had a few. The thing is, I love Mrs. Hughes. I do. I think that she's a very interesting character, and I do like the development she gets in this. It's not the best part for me, but I do like the development she gets. I have mixed feelings about this Beau plot line because it's kind of boring. I'm not
gonna. I don't know how else they would have done that.
I know that's the problem. I mean, am I okay with the fact that it's there? Sure, I guess it just exists, well, but it's not the most interesting thing in this episode.
And I will say this about the plotline: during that time, and especially for us non-British American, never had this kind of landed gentry background, outsider thing, it is helpful to see that a life of service was very meaningful for the people who did it.
Oh, sure. It contextualizes a lot. But yeah. And I think that it's important to give a little bit more substance to Mrs. Hughes. But I don't know. It was kind of boring. Then the Daisy love triangle. I absolutely despise her doting on Thomas, and there is a moment that we missed of Mrs. Patmore basically being like, he's not a ladies man.
No, that's actually in the next
episode. No, it's not. I wrote it down.
Okay, so but
it's in this episode.
But she says it repeatedly, because she says it again in the next episode.
He's not interested in you.
And Mrs. Patmore knows this shit, and for whatever reason Daisy's not listening.
And also just in general, I think that Daisy plotline, I hate Daisy being a bitch. I don't like it. It's important to set up stuff later on, because she does have knowledge that very few people have, and so it is important. O'Brien is annoying always, and Mosley's hands, I don't care. It's fine. Meh. it's just kind of boring. What about your least favorite parts?
Thomas and Daisy. That is the only thing I wrote down. And it's because, number one, I hate Daisy being a bitch to William. That is going to be a theme that is going to come up over and over and over again. I hate Thomas having influence on her, for her allowing him to have influence on her, and not hearing from everybody else who can see it, Thomas is a bad influence. You need to step away from him. And I think, you know, her gullibility, while I understand it, because, you know, she's a nothing, you know,
she doesn't get much attention.
Right. And well, and you hear later that her background is very
tragic.
Vague and tragic. But the fact that she idolizes him so much just because he's superficially attractive and knowledgeable, she buys into that in a way that I find disturbing and sad, right? Yeah. And so I find that whole plot line incredibly necessary on some level, but awful.
Yeah, sure. I had difficulty figuring out an overall grade. I think I originally put B+. I think it's more of a B for me. I there are a lot of things I really like about this, but it is mostly setting up stuff for later. So to a certain extent, it does kind of resolve, but like basically it's like, all right, well, we're not smashing the intel. So that's kind of resolved.
Right.
Feelings around it, not so much, but the actual matter of, are we going to challenge the intel or not, is completely resolved. It's like not going to happen.
Right. So I gave this a B also. And I think it's mostly because, to me, this is a very average, and it probably doesn't seem like that from the amount we've talked about it, very average Downton Abbey episode.
Yeah.
It is setting things up. It is life at the Abbey. That's part of the reason I have the Abbey cocktail, because this episode and the next episode are just like, hey, this is how life is at Downton Abbey. Some of which is better explored than others. And I think this next episode is a better episode. But I feel like it's good TV. It's not great TV. So I gave it a B.
All right.
So let's go on to part 5.
Episode 5. Here are the sections for episode 5. The Flower Show, Antony Strallon, Gwen, Anna, and Bates.
All right. So let's start with the shortest of these if we can.
Gwen is probably the shortest.
Yeah, Gwen is the shortest.
Gwen Flower Show. Well, maybe we should leave Antony Strallon in the Flower Show to the end. Gwen, we'll do Anna and Bates next.
Yeah. So Gwen has a
reoccurring
theme. It seems like a short plot line. It does get a good bit of airtime in this episode, but Gwen gets another interview, basically.
Because
Sybil's like, I'm submitting this. You need to get a job. I'm going to work on it. You need to do whatever you need to do. to get this job and the interviews tomorrow. So Sybil's so great. She's like, I have this extra suit that I'm not wearing anymore. I think it'd look great. I need to wear it for the interview.
Play hooky. But this was a setup in the last.
Pretend you're sick.
This is set up in the last episode that she gave her the suit, and she also told her, Anna hasn't been seen all day. No one's going to check on her.
A couple hours.
You can be sick and you can disappear for a couple hours for the interview.
Right, which is actually what happens. So she pretends that she has a headache, and Anna's like, oh, and Carson actually sees it. So Anna's like, yeah, she's not fit for man nor beast. There's only one more room left to do.
I can do it.
I can do it. So she and Sybil take the governor's cart, and they're going to go, the governor's cart being a horse cart, and they're going to go to this
interview. Moulton.
To Moulton in the cart. And so yes, they do.
And they go, she does the interview. On their way back, the horse goes lame, loses a shoe. Right. And
they're very late. They're late. They're worried about Sybil, particularly. Everybody's worried about Sybil. But they get back and
they have to walk back.
Right. They have to walk. There's mud. The horse that's pulling the cart is named Dragon, and they yell at him
that they're going to turn them into glue.
And he runs off, and they get muddy and whatever. So it's bad.
But they get back and they're fine.
Right. And one other thing is Mary's like, I wouldn't have gotten down from the cart and walked with the horse. And he's kind of like, yeah, you would.
Yeah, you would, bitch. But that's a different part.
Right. But Gwen's like, you know, oh, I don't know if I got the job. And she later finds out that she did not.
Mm-hmm.
And of course, she feels defeated at every tiny rejection. And Sybil's like, no, we're going to keep going.
But it makes sense why she would feel as bad as she does, because these are her opportunities to leave service. It's her dream, and she keeps getting rejected.
And she feels she has felt unworthy from the beginning.
Yeah. She's been uncertain about this, even though it is her dream, for a while. And so, yeah. But right. Sybil's being very nice and helping out, and she's determined to keep helping her.
Yeah, there's a fun plot line with Anna and Bates though in this episode.
Well, it kind of lends itself to like the Thomas stuff of it all.
Yeah,
so
Thomas sucks.
I know I named it Anna and Bates, but this section is very Thomas heavy.
It's Thomas and O'Brien heavy. Yeah.
So to begin with, Thomas is in Mr. Carson's office and he is stealing a bottle of wine. And Bates comes in looking for Mr. Carson, and Thomas quickly hides the bottle, but he thinks that it's still a possibility that Bates knows that he is stealing it.
Right. And then later Robert, the Earl, notices that a snuff box.
Because there are a couple moments here and there in earlier episodes where Mr. Carson's like, oh, we're missing a couple bottles of wine. Oh, we're there's a snuff box missing. And well, okay, that kind of is a little bit later, but basically there like a sugar sifter is missing or something. Really small things that could go missing and could have a explanation, but the explanation is actually Thomas. And so
because Thomas is awful.
I don't know why he's just stealing wine. I guess he just likes
to get drunk.
I guess he likes a good vintage.
I understand.
I wouldn't steal it though.
I wouldn't either. I'd be like, hey, there's some left over in this bottle.
Whatever. I think, and then so he talks to O'Brien and is like, I think he saw me stealing this bottle of wine. I'm kind of worried about it. And then O'Brien's like, well,
you need to turn the tables on him.
Turn the tables on him. Make sure that he can't get the chance to make you look bad. And so
the next day, Robert notices one of his snuff boxes is missing. And this is actually a callback to episode one where Bates had said, you know, it's so weird that we work so close to all of these very valuable items. And the snuff boxes were part of that discussion between Bates and Thomas.
Yes.
Like, you know, it's, you know, the, and none of it is ours. And so Thomas is like, yeah, I'm going to use this. So he steals his snuff box.
Yeah, and he plants it in Bates's room. So basically the word gets out. Carson talks to the servants or is just like, all right, the snuff box is missing. If anybody has any information, please come forward. We will find out who took it. And so Anna.
Anxiety.
Well, O'Brien says to Bates is like, I'm so sorry, Mr. Bates, what a horrible thing to have happened. You're the only one who goes into that room. So
it's clearly you. Yeah. Like, well, why are you picking on him? And Tom's like, he's the only one who goes in there. It's like, well, obviously not.
But okay. Clearly not. But either way, that there's even just saying that, I'm just like, come on, like, how obvious are you guys being? Right. So Anna talks to Bates later and is just like, hey, I think I know where that stuff box is. I think it's in your room. And Bates is like, wait, you don't think? It's like, no, of course not. I don't think you did it. I think that Thomas
planted
it in your room. And he's like, oh, okay. I think that makes a lot of sense.
Well, I think Bates was kind of onto it.
Oh, for sure. He had an idea.
He had an idea, but he wasn't sure exactly what they had done. And Anna, being a smart woman and more objective, she's like, yeah, that's what happened.
That's definitely what happened.
And what she says is, find it, give it to me, I'll plant it in O'Brien's room.
Or you can take it and then put it in Thomas's room. Either one. And then he's like, you naughty girl. And then she's like, fight fire with fire. That's what my mom says. And so I love, she has random phrases from her mom that are really fun.
Right. So apparently, like, in some break in the evening, because of course Bates is not serving at table.
I think it's after dinner.
Right.
So before servants' dinner, maybe.
Right. He goes up, he checks his room. He must have given it to Anna. And so afterward, you know, like, Mr. Carson brings it up again as the evening has progressed.
No. Carson doesn't bring it up. Anna does.
Anna's like, just like,
we need a search. Yeah, we need a search party right away.
And now that it's been mentioned, need to do it before anybody knows. Anybody has a chance to do anything. And both O'Brien and Thomas like run upstairs, like, oh my god, they know.
There's this moment where Mrs. Hughes knocks on O'Brien's room, like, door, and opens the door, and her room is a complete mess because she's been searching.
Yeah, and so, but it is returned to the Earl with some thought of, it was just misplaced.
And it's weird that they don't get in any trouble.
Nobody gets
in any trouble, and so, whatever.
Right, we don't see, that is an off-screen thing that
weird that they don't get in trouble at all. And Anna brings that up, and I'm like, I agree, Anna, what the fuck?
Yeah, so, oh my god. But Bates says, they know that I know.
Mm-hmm. But they're, and we'll finish up the Anna and Bates stuff and then talk a little bit more about Thomas and O'Brien, because they have more stuff that's tied into everything else. So basically, they're on their way to the flower show, which is another big element of this episode.
That is like the biggest element of this, and we'll talk about it.
But I think Auntie Starlin's a bit more.
Oh, yeah, sorry.
So basically, they're walking, and they're kind of just talking. Thank you. They're talking, and Anna's basically like, I wish you could just come out, like, with, because they, okay, we missed a part in here where they're in Edith's bedroom, and that's the last, like, little section that they need to clean.
Oh,
that's
so sweet.
And Bates comes in and helps Anna make the bed. And they're talking
about how they're feeling sorry for Edith. Go ahead.
They talk about how, I've always kind of felt sorry for Lady Edith. And she's like, I don't know why I do. And she's just like, I went with Mr. Patrick, she was always had that unrequited love. And he's just like, yeah, it's very sad. Well, he doesn't directly be like, it's very sad about the unrequited love thing, but right. She starts describing, yeah, I think it's always sad when someone loves them who doesn't love them back. And then he's just like, and no, it's sad that he died.
Right. But he recognizes the hint. And before they leave the room, he says to her, maybe he did love her, but he couldn't, it would be inappropriate for him to speak because he had other things going on.
Like Mary,
like for Mr. Patrick, yeah, but yeah. For Bates,
it's an unspoken thing
that he is saying to Anna. There's other shit going on. I'm really sorry.
So on their way to the flower show, she basically is like, "I wish you'd just come out with whatever you're keeping secret because this is ridiculous." And then he's like, "You have a right to know, but it's still very, very complicated." And she's just, and he's like, "I'm not a free man." And she's like, "Are you trying to tell me you're married?" And he's just like, "I've been married." It's complicated. I can't talk to you about it. And she's just like, but I love, and then she says, I love you.
Oh, and she's like, I know it's not ladylike to say it.
But I'm not lady, and I do not pretend to be.
And he's like, you're lady to me.
It's really
funny. And so, like,
I love how direct Anna is about, like, I love you. Well, I'm sorry.
Mm-hmm. Well, but I love that Bates doesn't blow her off.
No, right? He loves her too.
Right. And he more or less acknowledges that. He doesn't say it in the same words,
right,
but he makes it clear to her, and she gets it. because she's very perceptive. And I love that about Anna throughout this whole series.
She's great.
But he says, like, it's complicated. I can't talk about it because like shit would go down.
And she kind of lets him do that. But at the same time, she expresses her disappointment because she does love him. Yeah. And she just wants to be with him. But again, he's keeps saying it's complicated and that's the whole thing. You'll get more information later.
Yep.
Basically season two.
Right. So that is pretty much it for Anna and Bateson's episode.
Well, there's Thomas and O'Brien. Yeah. So basically what's going on with them is on top of everything, and they're busy little bees.
I hate them.
We know. I hate them too. So there's this whole thing with Daisy. Daisy, at the very beginning of the episode, they're in Lady Mary's room, putting stuff together and making her bed. And Daisy's making the fire. And she is really spooked. And there's like this little noise that is made. And she jumps and she's all skittish. And she's just like, I hate this room. And Gwen and Anna are like, why? and she's just like, no reason. And then walks away. And so Anna brings it up again at like dinner or something where she's just like with the other servants. She's like, Daisy, are you feeling okay? She had quite a turn in that room. And Daisy's just like, I'm just keep thinking about like, there's been so much death in the house.
The Titanic and
now this and the whole like Turkish diplomat guy, Pamuk. And they're just like, well, what does that have to do with Lady Mary's bedroom? And then she's like, nothing. Like,
yeah, right.
And
because she didn't actually see them coming out of Lady Mary's bedroom.
That's the thing. I'm like, why are you doing it here?
They saw him carrying them.
She saw Mary, not anybody else. She only saw Mary.
Well, but Mary only has the feet. So she knows other people are involved.
Oh, she knows other people are involved, but she's only saw Mary. And so basically she is, there's this whole thing. And Thomas and O'Brien are kind of like, well, she must know something because they already know that Pamuk was taken by Thomas to Lady Mary's bedroom and he somehow ended up back in his room. And they kind of figure that it was Mary's doing to put him back there. Mm-hmm. And so and there's also this other dimension that we'll be mentioning in a second, but they think Daisy saw something. And so they try to ask her about it, but Daisy's not going to talk to them about it because she just won't. And there's a moment where O'Brien goes,
just terrible. Let's face it, she's stirring shit and she knows Edith hates Mary. Yes. So she figures, let's get Edith on it.
And so she goes to Edith, and I feel like this could have been a better moment if they I was thinking of last episode where Anna was sick. Never mind. I was thinking they could have utilized the fact that O'Brien's looking after Edith, but that's not true in this episode. Never mind. Either way, O'Brien goes to Edith and is like, there is something troubling me. Like when she mentions, oh yeah, Sybil's back. The horse went lame. She walked back. So she tells Edith, Daisy, there's something up with Daisy. She's talking about this Pamuk guy and she
won't tell us.
She won't tell us what's going on. And we think it has something to do with Lady Mary, but we don't know what. And so, naturally, she goes to Edith. And so Edith is just like, take her to me after breakfast. Mm-hmm. And so Daisy's brought to Edith, and Daisy tells her what she knows, which is basically just that she saw Mary taking him to his room. That's basically all she knows. And it's the dead body, so it's a little bit more scandalous, but still. There's also an element before we move on from Thomas and O'Brien, that there's this rumor going around in London that Evelyn Napier doesn't want to marry Mary because of something wrong with her character, and maybe that she's not a virgin. And so, and this was spread by Thomas via other, like, valets or footmen, his little network. He, like, sent a letter about it. I don't know why you mentioned that in a letter, but whatever. So that it got out because of Thomas. And so that's basically all of that. So the flower show is kind of shorter. We can talk about just the basic stuff that happens beforehand Then we can talk about Antony Strahlin. That happens in the middle. And then at the very end, the flower show is again. So the flower show is an annual thing that is, you just basically show off the best blooms in the village. And there is a Grantham Cup that is awarded to the best bloom in the village. And Lady Grantham, not Cora, but Violet, always wins. So basically, Molesley has in his dad take great pride in their garden, and they have these roses that they are very, very proud of, and they really want to win the Grantham Cup. And Isabel is on their side, obviously, because she has to be on everyone's side other than Violet's. And so she basically wants to be their champion and to convince Violet to let them win.
Right. But again, everybody, and it's not just Isabel, acknowledging that Mr. Mosley, the older Mr. Mosley, has amazing and beautiful gardening, beautiful roses, amazing gardening skills. You know, he is doing extraordinary things with making
hybrids and all this other stuff.
But he's never recognized.
It's
always the Dowager Countess.
Right. And Isabel keeps denying that she has a hold on it, but is so freaking obvious. Including Robert.
You said Isabel.
Oh, I'm sorry. But it's so clear to everybody, including Robert. And he at some point is super sarcastic about it. I think because, she's like, well, I could win on merit. And Robert's like, I think the proper response at this point is yes, dear. he's just like.
But I think the best part about this is that I think personally that Violet doesn't know that that is an unspoken rule.
Right.
That she never, I don't think she ever put somebody up to that.
Right.
I think that they just naturally are like, well, we need to keep her happy. So we'll give it to her every single time. And she is in denial about the fact that
it
could be a possibility. And so over the course of the episode, Isabel tries to go to Violet and is like, release them from this oath. Please just let.
Like, there is no oath. What are you talking about?
And genuinely, I don't think she has any idea. But then at the very, do you want to skip to the end? I mean, a lot happens at the flower show, but it's related to Antony Strahlin stuff.
Right. Yeah. And we do need to talk about that at some point, but go ahead.
So, and there's this great line that I adore.
That is so good.
Where they're at the
preliminary, they're setting up for the flower show. Yes. There are several scenes that are setups for it, but this is the night before or something.
The day before. Yeah.
Yeah.
And Isabel, they're looking at the flowers and they see Molesley's beautiful red roses. And
Cora's even like, can you come talk to our gardener? Because those are gorgeous and I want some.
Yeah. And so they're talking and Isabel's just trying to be like, oh, well, he should win. He absolutely should win. He's amazing. Oh, my God.
And Violet's response is, oh, it's amazing how you see room for improvement
everywhere you look. And then Isabel says, I take that as a compliment. And Violet says, I must have said it wrong.
and the delivery by Maggie Smith is fantastic.
I think that's one of my absolute favorite
lines. Violet has so many great lines, but it's like, yeah, girl, you go.
And then we'll get to... There's another line I want to mention when we get to Antony Strahlin that's so funny to me. Mm-hmm. But we get at the flower show when they're handing out the Grantham Cup. It's actually Violet who's handing out the awards, so that's interesting. So she gets to the best bloom in the village, and her name is written down as the winner.
But she
says, all right, is Mr. William Molesley, and she gives the award to Molesley instead.
And everyone's shocked.
Yeah.
Everyone, including obviously Mr. Mosley, but I think everybody also knows that she has been kind of shamed into this. And so everyone congratulates her for acknowledging it.
And then she's like, no, it was all on his merit. So
Don't worry about the judges. I have nothing to do with it.
Yeah.
But everyone knows
that she did this for him.
Yeah.
And regardless of if it's out of shame or anything, it was the right thing to do.
And the fact that she does it
and doesn't take credit for anything.
Yes.
The fact that she doesn't take credit for it is the biggest part, because it's just, it's not like, oh, I did this for him, it's all good. It's more she's like, no, the judges did that, it's fine. I'm not a sore loser, it's okay. But it's nice. All right. There's also a moment that we mentioned, which kind of confuses our timeline a bit, where Isabel, at the very beginning, when she's at the flower show, she's just like, when are you going to put up those beautiful prizes from last year?
Yeah, this is a timeline continuity issue, right?
For us.
So she's like, yeah, I remember the prizes from last year. And we're kind of like, okay, you were in town last year? You know about this? What are you talking about?
And so we have this theory that it is now 1914, it is spring 1914.
Right. And that this and the next several episodes are kind of like a time crunch, because there are weird time leaps that are never explained in this show.
Yes.
And I think that this and the next several episodes are all 1914.
It also makes me wonder why Isabel didn't notice any of this kind of buffoonery last year. Just like, oh, Violet always gets it. Like, she was already a bit antagonistic with Violet before, so I don't understand why she wouldn't have tried to be the Molesley's champion then, but it's okay. Yeah. It happens now and it's great. So now we'll get to Anthony Strallen.
Yes.
You must be wondering, who the fuck is that?
So he is a local lord. He is a sir.
Yes.
Sir Anthony Strallen has he has an estate nearby.
And he is as old as Robert.
or very close in age to Robert. And so Cora is kind of like, we need to invite him to dinner because Mary needs to marry somebody.
And it's just like, why Anthony Strong?
Well, and even Robert's kind of like, he's my age. Are you kidding?
And dull as paint. Like, yes, come on. And so, but Cora does not relent. She just is like, all right,
inviting him to dinner, damn it.
And she also is trying to get Mrs. Patmore to make
a special
pudding, an apple charlotte pudding, instead of the regular raspberry meringue. But Mrs. Patmore is like, no, I can't do that on such short notice. And she's very hesitant.
And Mrs. Hughes is even kind of like, that seems weird.
And this is doesn't just like apples
and butter and sugar and flour. Why is this a big deal?
But it is a big deal for Mrs. Patmore. We don't know why.
Patmore is like fucking awful to Daisy.
Well, let's talk about that. Daisy is like, well, I can read the recipe to you if that's an issue or a problem. And then Mrs. Patmore is like, problem? Who said anything about a problem? How dare you say that in front of her ladyship? And then as soon as Cora and Mrs. Hughes leave and talk, where Cora's just like, you need to watch out for that poor girl. She's going to get eaten alive.
Yeah.
And in the background, you hear Mrs. Patmore and Daisy talking. Daisy's like, I was only trying to help. And she's like, you were trying to help? Judas was only trying to help when he led the Roman guards to the garden.
It's
so funny.
So great.
So many great lines in this episode.
Yes.
Anyway. Yes. The day is upon us and Anthony Strallen is coming to dinner. And there is also a moment before this where Mary's about to post a telegram and she runs into Matthew and she's just like, oh, are you and Edith going to do another church visit? She's barking up the wrong tree. And it's okay.
It's so cool that like Matthew says that to her, because I love that he's making it clear. Like, he's not trying to keep his options open. He loves Mary.
Well, okay, and he doesn't really say it.
I know, but he's like, look, I of all the peoples, it's not you.
He's basically saying this obvious flirtation thing, I'm not interested in it.
Yeah.
And so that opens it up a little bit, and Mary clocks that. And there's also even a moment where Isabel and Matthew are talking, and Isabel's even like, let's do the church thing. And Matthew's like, I don't want to give her the wrong impression, which is fair.
Right.
He shouldn't try to do that, but
right.
Either way.
But Isabel's kind of like, oh, you know, these are family.
I hope that she's barking up the wrong tree. It's like, I hope Edith finds a tree somewhere. And yes, it's like, yeah.
So sweet. Because again, you know, there are going to be later episodes where we're all kind of like, oh, poor you.
Well, we'll get there, but not yet.
Not yet. Because right now, Edith's a bitch.
Well, so we'll get to that more later. But yes. At dinner, Matthew and Mary are sitting next to each other, and Antony Strom is on her other side.
Right. And there are very strict rules for how conversations are supposed to go at dinner. So this is one of those extremely weird British formal dinner things involving rich people, where you talk to the person on one side until your hostess then turns and talks to the person on their other side. So Mary has to wait to talk to other people at the table until her mother allows her to speak to the person on her other side.
Yeah.
So she has to talk to Antony Strahl, and he's talking about like
farming
and tractors.
But nothing interesting about farming that she's actually interested in.
Right. I mean, it's interesting if you're interested in like Industrial Revolution kinds of things.
Well, it's not even that interesting. But so he's boring her. She quickly like does a little thing to Matthew and is like, can we please turn? And I really just can't talk to this guy anymore.
Interesting in this dynamic is that Edith, who's across the table and not seated next to Antony Strahl, is kind of like saying something to him about this technology. Like, I'd love to see a harvester if you let me. And he's kind of like, I'd love that. That'd be great.
She's piqued his interest.
Right.
And Mary kind of clocks that and is just like, okay, weird.
Well, and whatever. Because she is like stupid competitive with anybody that she sees as any kind of threat, like Mary's kind of like,
weird. And so, even though she's not even interested in the guy, but they're finally allowed to turn and she does. But downstairs.
A lovely chat with Matthew.
Well, before we get to that, downstairs. Pat Moore is struggling and she drops a chicken on the ground because she misjudges she misjudges like where the table was or something like that. And but they fix that by just like putting it on a tray and being like, what they don't know
what vegetables around it. I'm gonna see the cat bit it. Okay.
And so they do that, and then as the pudding's about to go up, she's like, wait, I need to put sugar on it. To make it,
like it sinks in too much if you put it too early.
And so she puts it on and it goes up. Now Mary and Matthew are just kind of talking, but they do talk about like the village and all that stuff. So like she can be interested in this kind of conversation, but only when it's interesting and with a better person. And so they're talking and it's really cute. And then there's this moment where Antony Strahl takes a bite of his pudding and goes, oh, good God. And
which is a hilarious line that we have held on to for years.
We love it. And he just had a mouthful of salt. And he was assaulted. And so
Cora tastes hers. She's like, oh, we need to get this taste out of our mouths. Is this barely anybody tried the pudding? Yeah, it's like this big drama about, oh my God,
it's salt. Seems like, okay.
It's funny. I mean, salted caramel could be a thing back in the
day. But it's a raspberry meringue. It does not go that. All right. But Mary and Matthew are giggling in the corner, like just looking at each other and just laughing. It's funny.
Right. And it's sweet that they are having this connection.
It's really cute.
It's so cute. And Matthew's clearly like, she likes me, because he does like her. Genuinely find it funny. It's not like he's just laughing because
she is. It's so cute. Anyway, then tragedy strikes,
and it strikes while the women have retired and the men have retired.
Oh, nobody dies, but what happens? It just happens to my heart, but basically what happens is the women go in the drawing room and Edith is being praised by her mother of, oh, you saved the day with Antony Strahl and you kept him distracted. Good job.
And Mary's like, oh, good God.
Because she's like making fun of it. It is funny. But Mary, like Edith is trying to one-up Mary by being like, well, I helped out. I actually did what you were supposed to be doing this entire time and showing interest and actually the one being flung, even though I'm the one doing all the work. And so
Mary's kind of like, oh yeah, I could take him anytime. And she's kind of
you think this is a challenge? Like,
challenge accepted.
Like, I will absolutely, like, I will take
him. I will win this anytime.
Yes. And so when the boys come in, and before they even come in, Robert is talking to Matthew and he's just like, well, I hope the salty pudding hasn't really ruined your evening. And he's like, on the contrary, it's actually been really nice. And he's been having a great time.
Yeah, Matthew said, I'm going to have a great time with Mary when we get back in the same room.
We have an inside joke now. And so they're walking in and Mary's like, oh, I've been looking for you. And Matthew assumes it's for him. And she walks past Matthew, goes straight to Anthony Stroud and shows him a book.
Right. And and is kind of like trying to engage Anthony Stroud, and he's fascinated by the book that Mary has shown.
Which I also think that she could have just waited for Mary to be done and then tried her hand at it.
So
that
she would be
even more polite.
Right, but she didn't. So she gets feels thrown over by Anthony Stroud. She goes to Matthew, and Matthew's clearly upset. He's like, oh, I've got a headache, I've got to go.
What she says is, we've both been thrown over for a bigger prize. And it's like, oh God, Edith, don't.
And Matthew's like, I don't want to be associated with you.
And so he leaves. Yeah. And Mary notices, and she's like, wait, no, whoa, I wasn't.
Right. She runs out, because she's not serious about Andrew Sherrill. She's never, ever, ever going to be interested in him seriously.
Which I also...
Why it's stupid for her to have done this.
Stupid for her to have done it. I think also Matthew, like, getting as upset, like, he could have at least asked her about that, like, given that a minute or two and then asked about it. But to be fair, Edith saying that, and it's like, well, they must have had some kind of conversation because clearly something happened. Mm-hmm. And so the very quick change of that, I think is what really bugged him.
Right. So for him to hear that from Edith is almost like, oh my God, Mary thinks he's a prize. Shit.
Yeah. He leaves and he walks instead of getting the car. It's so dramatic. Like,
I need to be out of here now.
And Mary goes after him. She goes into the hallway and is just like, wait, where's he? And where's Matthew?
And Liam's kind of like,
he preferred to walk. And she watches him leave and she's like, damn it.
And it's not what I'm going to do. During this, Cora talks to Robert and Robert's like, she just feels like she can put down her toys and expect them to be there
when she comes back.
And that again, you know, that
and Robert's the picture, one who says that,
right? The big picture view from Robert is something so good. That it is really good, because a lot of times we feel like he's a little superficial, but he gets like undercurrents in a way that we're not always
I think he also notices how in like just interested Matthew is in Mary, and how much he really just cares about her well-being.
Right.
And so her not showing anything in return, especially like since Anthony Stroud is there, her not showing interest in him in return, especially like after dinner, which is usually when that happens, it's disappointing. And so that's basically that scene. But then at the flower show, Mary goes up to Matthew. He's like,
to apologize.
Well, she basically is like, well, me and Edith had this like bet, and I hope you didn't get the wrong.
That's so offensive. Like,
well, no, before that, she's just like, I hope I didn't give you the wrong impression or was rude last night. Me and Edith have this bet, and Matthew's like, I shouldn't have monopolized your time.
But you think about this from his point of view. He's like, I don't even pay your fucking bet.
I think that's also another thing where he could have like listened to her and then been like, what the fuck? No.
Yeah. Because it might have been worse if he had stopped and listened to her.
Technically, he wasn't the one that was a part of the bet. It was Anthony Stroud.
But you're the one that's being thrown over this for some stupid ass bullshit.
I don't disagree, Mom, but at the same time, I think that, again, a little bit more communication from everybody would have been gone a long way. But I think her explaining that she's not interested in Anthony Stroud would have gone a long way. But either way, she didn't get that chance. And he's basically like, I shouldn't have taken all of your time. Sorry. Bye. And just kind of ignores her. And so then Edith goes up to her and is just like, oh, so I wonder why he was in such a rush to get away. And she's just like, I just know that if I was going after a man, I'd avoid those clothes and that hat.
Right. And admittedly, Edith is not being shown to best advantage in the clothing she is wearing. But
no,
it is right.
I don't mind her red dress for dinner, but like otherwise, it's kind of like, eh.
Mary's red dress for dinner is definitely
it's so much better.
But I think that that's the whole purpose of how they are being presented. But yeah, and she's kind of snide offhand, whatever. But that's basically the whole story. Is there one more?
No, there's a big thing at the end.
Oh, yes. Edith.
Well, it's really big. So basically, Edith. Yes, Edith's pissed as Mary, like she's just like, Edith's like, you act like you're so superior. And then Mary just goes, ah. And then she walks away. And Edith's like, well, I think those who last love longest. And I'm just like, okay, that's a weird thing to say. Right. Just then to yourself. We
see her at the end of this episode writing a letter
to the Turkish ambassador in London. And it's going to be, we completely forgot about this one scene where Mary and Cora are talking before dinner, and Cora's like, you need to take care of Anthony Strallen. And she's like, do I have to? And then she's like, yes, you kind of have to, because there is a rumor in London that you are not virtuous. And Edith overhears this, so she gets that context.
Right, okay. No, and I want to explore this a little bit more. So Mary's like, oh, do I have to? And there's a rumor, and Cora says there's a rumor. And Mary's like, well, times are changing. And
not fast like, enough for you.
Not fast enough for you. This is going to hurt you. Hang on. And so Edith overhears this exchange between Cora and Mary. So Mary's kind of like, well, it's not like, you know, Edith's got a lot of opportunity. You need to focus on Edith. And Cora's kind of like, well, you know, Edith doesn't have the advantages you have. And Edith overhears that.
Well, Mary says no, some, like fewer, she has none at all. But also what Mary says is like, about what happened. It's like, what happened with my lover, Kamal Pamuk. Like she literally spells it out. Right, exactly. And Edith is overhearing all this. So she has the context that Daisy gave her, especially the context that Mary and Cora just gave her.
Right.
So she has the entire story in her head, at least right. With minus Anna. And mine is Cora helping, but right. She can assume all those things.
Right, but Cora knows.
And, but also, she doesn't want to throw Cora in it. Well, she also just doesn't want to throw Cora under the bus either. It's not meant for Cora. But right. She basically has the entire story, and she tells it to the Turkish ambassador, and she sends it in a letter.
Yeah. And so that's where the episode ends.
Yeah.
What were your best parts of this episode?
I had a couple. Violet and Isabel, I think this is one of their best adversarial things, because it shows I can sometimes be a little bit annoyed by Isabel and her like savior complex of like, mm-hmm. I need to help out everybody at all times. I'm
progressive.
And I am so progressive. Look at me. I'm a nurse. I don't know. I think that she can get a little bit on my nerves. But Violet not knowing that this was happening, and her thinking that she was actually accomplishing something, but wasn't getting it on merit, according to just like thinking about it, she isn't getting it on merit.
Yeah.
And her giving that up, I think, is a great storyline. And it shows that her humanity a lot more. The drama at dinner. Oh, mwah! I love the drama. It's like, as much as I hate that Matthew and Mary aren't like getting along or whatever, it makes for great TV. It's really good to see. It's so much fun. Oh, another thing really quickly, Mrs. Pamor's going blind and Carson knows, and now.
And that's she's been so awful to Daisy.
Yes. Well, that's not why she's been so awful to Daisy. It's been why she's had reasons to blame stuff on Daisy. But
right, no, I mean, not that Daisy has deserved it in any way. And, no. And Carson's like, you kind of owe her an apology.
Yeah, but they're gonna try to figure stuff out with her either way. Just Carson, that part with Carson I really like, because Carson, it shows how much he cares about his employees.
Right.
And how,
and the operation of Downton,
and just how kind he is to her. It's nice. Yes. And Anna and Bates, I love their part of this story. I think it's just fun. But yeah, those are my best parts. What about you?
All right, so my best parts are the quotes. This is one of the most quotable episodes in Downton Abbey, especially in the early seasons, but overall. I mean, this is one of those episodes that you hold on to these quotes because they are so well written and well delivered. I love the Dowager Countess conceding that acknowledgement on her part. And I love Thomas and O'Brien losing, you know, because they're awful and they should lose. And I like that they're getting at least some comeuppance. It's not permanent, but it's something. And I love that. So those were my best parts. What are your worst parts?
Thomas and O'Brien, Mary being stupid and Edith being petty. Here's the problem. I can completely understand why Edith is annoyed. I can absolutely understand why she thinks that why the fuck do I get nothing when Mary gets absolutely everything thrown at her?
Right. I'm trying to do everything right.
Dude. I'm trying, and I can't succeed if I'm given the opportunity. But when she eggs Mary on, that's when things go south for her. I wish she learned that lesson sooner. But I think that her being like, well, you've insulted my clothes, and you also were just...
You insulted me. I can win.
Well, also just challenge the whole challenge thing. Even though Edith's the one who challenges her, she kind of gave it thrown it on, like it went badly for Edith. But it is kind of Edith's fault for challenging her in the first place. But it getting as nasty as it did is partly Mary.
Yeah,
and so. But then her response being, I'm going to ruin your entire reputation. I will
for the world.
To the whole world. And also the Turkish ambassador specifically. And also...
But that's part of the world. It's much bigger than just like London.
I'm aware. And also it coming from me, your sister, validates it way more than just idle gossip from footmen. So it is really, really bad. And also it will reflect badly on your family in general. So Edith, think for 2 seconds about maybe this could hurt you too.
Yeah, she's petty bitch.
Either way, it makes for great TV, and it is dramatic, and it is great. And I think this is just, I'll talk a little bit more in overall grade, but go ahead.
My worst parts are Thomas and O'Brien because they are horrible.
Yes.
And again, that awful, awful conniving pettiness is terrible. And of course, I didn't write it down, but I feel that way about Edith too. It's like, that
it's like Eloise Bridgerton of it all, of being like, oh, I'm just gonna do this random thing and I'm not gonna think about the consequences.
Well, but Eloise is,
it's way more annoying when Eloise is
right, but because Eloise, you know, on some level has good intentions and she is a little bit more direct. This indirect, god awful, conniving shit.
Actually, and I think this is more direct.
No, but Edith is terrible. I didn't write that down. I also wrote down Mrs. Pentmore being awful to Daisy because, again, it's funny, but I feel like Mrs. Pentmore is better than that, number one. Number two, that kind of projecting onto somebody else or not acknowledging your own fault thing. And I understand the fear that is the cause of it for Mrs. Pentmore. She talks about, oh, God, a blind cook, who's ever heard of that? And you know, she's worried about losing her position. What am I going to do? I'm going to die and die destitute, blah, 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 all those things. I understand where she's coming from, that fear, but I feel like she's just so horrible to Daisy about it. You don't need to be that level of terrible.
Sure. What's your overall grade?
I gave it an A-. I love this episode on so many levels. It is so quotable. It is so well-written. It is well-structured. The only reason I didn't give it an A is, again, I know there are better episodes. So I'm kind of, this might be an A. I gave it an A-.
I gave it an A.
Okay.
The reason why is, well, I already kind of knew I was going to give it an A just right off the bat, even before I rewatched it, because this is one of the episodes I rewatched the most. Mm. I really love it so much. Like whenever I go back to the first season, I tend to avoid certain episodes, like the third episode with the whole Kamala Pamuk thing. I don't know why I usually avoid that one. I think it's more just, I love the aftermath of it more than I love the actual happening. Oh, no, I love the episode, but it's not one I revisit all that often. It's why I gave it an A- instead of an A, but the ripples of that are so much more interesting to me than the actual act of it happening. So I love this episode for so many reasons. Like you get all of the drama that like, and you get the development with Matthew and Mary of them. Like there's even a moment where when Cora approaches Mary about like, oh yeah, well, you're going to have to take care of Auntie Strallen. And she's like, when am I going to have to stop? Like, when can I stop like getting thrown at every person I talk to at dinner? And she's just like, until it sticks, because now you won't take Matthew. It's like, well, I'd take Matthew any day over that guy.
I'm late for that.
Well, no, Cora's like, I'm glad you're thinking of cousin Matthew even better. And she's just like, that's not the point.
but she doesn't deny it. But Cora also says to her, you know, when you rejected Matthew, you were in a different position than you are now.
Mm-hmm.
And now you're fucked, basically.
Yeah, and they're, yeah, literally. But there was even a moment last episode where Cora's like, you should keep Matthew close because he can protect you from the...
Well, and Mary's kind of like, oh yeah, I'm going to need a protector because when I ruin myself, I might need someone to stand up for me. And
well,
like,
not necessarily true.
Well, not just that, but also you need a place to sleep. Yeah. Like, he's the one who's going to be taking care of Downton. If your dad's not there to help you, Matthew's the one who's legitimate enough to help you out there and to give you security like that. So I think just in general, I love the development with Matthew and Mary.
I love the drama. I love the quotes. The quotes are amazing. The Judas line is hilarious, and yes, I love it so much. True. I love all the Violet and Isabel
stuff.
There are
so many quotes in here, and we didn't touch on half of them.
Because they're just all so good.
Yeah.
And then Anna and Bates versus Thomas and O'Brien is so perfect. It's
and
the
iconic
epitome.
For this show,
it yes. is the epitome of a wonderful Downton Abbey episode. It is not my favorite episode ever of all Downton Abbey. That is... later.
To come.
That is to come, and we will get there, and
yes,
I'm excited for it.
Me too.
But this is just a precursor to, there are a lot of episodes, just random episodes, not even like finales or anything like that, that I will give an A because it's something I visit all the time. I think of it as the epitome of Downton Abbey of a specific season. There are usually at least one episode per season that I'm probably going to give an A or an A plus, depending. So this is one of the A's for me. I love this episode. If you haven't watched it, you should. It's really good. It's funny.
Right.
It's dramatic.
So, to be fair, love this it. Is probably an A episode, but we did give an A to episode 3.
Did we give an A to episode 3?
We did.
Well, okay. Yeah, it's going to be there are several that I'm going to give an A.
Right.
Because I just have to. It's
right.
If you are watching Downton Abbey, you should just watch all of it because, I mean, there's not that many episodes, but
If
you're skipping around
and don't have all the time.
Yes. This is usually how I would rewatch in the past. I would just be like, well, which ones are the episodes that I really just enjoy? So I already know like the Pamuk stuff, I tend not to go for episode 3. I usually go for this episode because it ties in a lot of Pamuk stuff, but it's full of all
right,
the other
but
stuff.
If
I
you've
love.
Not watched episode 3, you absolutely should. It's
oh, sure.
a great episode. And this is a great episode.
It's
well.
A very great episode of TV. It's so fun. I'm also very excited for the next two episodes. They have a lot of moments that I love as well. So I'm excited. And also a lot of moments that make me angry. But we'll get to them.
Yes, we will, because we can't wait to share with you more of Downton Abbey.
Oh, and just you wait for season 2.
Oh my God, season 2.
Oh my God, season 2.
I shouldn't say it. So anyway, but
you'll say it off camera.
I will say it off camera. But in any case, we hope that you join us. You get that Downton Abbey cocktail book too.
Oh, you have a really good
you give us some no I'm telling
if you like gin.
Well, I mean, there are other things in there,
we'll
but a lot of them
well.
Have like brandy and whiskey and those kinds of things, so if you don't have those, you need to like store them. But we hope that you join us, and
cheers.